Of the Roland Unified School District Board of Education to order. It is now 4 o'clock p.m. Dr. Mitchell, will you please do roll call?
Yes, absolutely. Carrie Chen?
Here.
Lynn Ebenkamp?
Here.
Angelina Pride?
Present.
David Malkin?
Present.
And Donna Friedman?
Here.
All board members are present.
Are there any changes or items to be pulled from the agenda?
None from staff.
May I have a motion to adopt the agenda of the board study session of Thursday, October 24th, 2019?
I make a motion.
I second.
Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. All in attendance will be led in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag by Board Vice President David M. Malkin.
Please rise. Face the flag over here. Put your right hand over your heart and recite after me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Step back. All
right. Would he get me out of meeting?
There you go.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, David. Dr. Mitchell, are there any public comments? Please note the public is welcome to provide comment to the board. Remarks are limited to 3 minutes unless extended or limited by vote of the board. A maximum of 20 minutes unless extended by the board is allocated for each subject discussed. The Brown Act open meeting regulations under which the board must operate do not allow board members to comment on non-agenda items or information you may bring up that are not in the agenda. Additionally, no action can be taken. However, the board may give direction to staff following a comment. Roy Humphreys.
Okay, good day. I'm Roy Humphreys, and thank you for all the good things you do. And I'm bringing in this part. It's an agenda item, but I have a lot to go for the when agenda, the public meeting comes up. And this is to address a situation where on October 12th, I had submitted a demand letter to Superintendent Mitchell, and I'll read it. As I have previously noted, the handling of the CVR, that's California Voting Rights Act, process is an insult to the constituents of this district. You have willfully refused and failed to video record the public meetings and publish them so that the entire district could share, could have the opportunity to engage the process. You have completely ignored the north side of the district by holding all of the meetings at the district office, and we're talking about the 4 scheduled required meetings by law, which is woefully inadequate, and this is a blatant act of exclusion. On behalf of the disenfranchised and excluded, it is demanded that you immediately, and we'll discuss that term later, remedy this situation to be all-inclusive. Thank you.
Next, we will have a public hearing regarding the California Voting Rights Act and transition from an at-large to by-trustee area-based voting system for school board members. The board took action and adopted Resolution SO 171801 on September 14, 2017, to transition to a by-trustee area electoral system commencing with the November 2020 election to ensure compliance with the California Voting Rights Act, CVRA. The board will, with holding the second a public hearing to receive input from the community on the criteria that will be utilized to establish the trustee area map and identify the trustee areas in which elections will be held in 2020 and 2022. Prior to the opening of the public hearing, Larry Fershaw from Cooperative Strategies will present information on the transition from at-large elections to by-trustee area elections. I will turn it over to Dr. Mitchell at this time.
Thank you very much. And so I will invite Larry Fershaw to the podium, and I believe that we have, there it is, the clicker. Thank you. So that you can share your presentation.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you again for being here.
Dr. Mitchell, good afternoon, members of the board. Have a brief presentation to go over to kind of set the stage for the public hearing. It's similar to, or maybe exactly the same as the one we had 2 weeks ago at the first pre-map public hearing, but just as a refresher, under the education code, there's three different ways that school boards can be elected. The current at-large method, a from-area method of election where the district is divided into different areas, but everybody still votes at large, and then the method that you're transitioning to, which is the by-area method of election, where there's going to be five different voting areas within the district. One member is elected from each area and only by the members of those respective areas. And that's the only method of election that is immune from challenge under the California Voting Rights Act. And so that's the method that you're transitioning to. The California Voting Rights Act took effect back in 2003, and it prohibits the use of at-large elections where it can be shown that that method of election results in the impairment of members of protected classes, which are historical, racial, or ethnic minority groups in the country, from being able to influence the outcome of election because of racially polarized voting. And the board has, as we mentioned, taken action to transition away from the at-large method of election to a by-trustee area method of election. This is the calendar of meetings that have been held so far at board meetings. So we held the first pre-map public hearing October 10th, and today's second pre-map public hearing. I know there's also been some community meetings that have occurred at different sites across the district where, Dr. Mitchell, you've gone out and met with the community groups to talk about the pre-map public hearing stage. So those have also occurred. We haven't put them on the calendar yet, but we'll add those just so we can be transparent about the meetings that have occurred. The next step is on November 14th, we'll have the initial scenarios available for a public hearing at the board meeting. 7 days prior to that, so on or about November 7th, those will be posted to the district's website for the public to see, and that's required 7-day public review period prior to the public hearing on the maps. We will then have a second public hearing on December 12th, and at that time, the board could select one of those maps to move forward with and hold an additional public hearing first, and then also a public hearing on the waiver application to waive the necessity to have an election on the district's transition. And that's a common occurrence that districts seek this waiver and receive it from the State Board of Education. If there are any changes that come to the map, so after November 14th, members of the board may say, we want to see some changes to these maps. We'll certainly make sure to incorporate any changes and have those posted at least 7 days in advance of the December 12th meeting. So by no means are the maps that get posted on November 14th the only maps that you will see. If there are comments, if there are changes that get suggested, that will certainly be part of this process. The rest of the dates are just kind of different approval processes that have to happen from the County Committee on School District Organization and the State Board of Education to get this wrapped up for the November 2020 election. The next item on your agenda after the public hearing is just a resolution to approve the criteria. So we've summarized on this on the slide in terms of what we're going to be looking at, assuming the board approves that resolution in a few moments. That some of these are legal requirements that are laid out, that each area has to be roughly equal in terms of the total population, that they have to be drawn in a manner that complies with the Federal Voting Rights Act, that they shall be contiguous and compact as possible. Communities of interest should be respected. We're going to consider other jurisdictional boundaries as much as possible. We're going to look at having schools be represented by more than one trustee to the extent possible, and also look at it to the extent possible and as permitted under the law, avoid having pairings of trustees in the same area. Again, that's on the list of priorities, but it is the last of the list of priorities. Just a little bit of background on the district's demographic data. We're going to be using the 2010 census data for this exercise to identify roughly five roughly equal areas in terms of total population. So you can see 108,603 people as of the 2010 census, which means five roughly equal areas of 21,700 and change. We'll have to look at these numbers again after the 2020 census data is released in about April of 2021 to see if there's been any shifts in population that would require us to make adjustments to get back under the 10% variance that we're allowed between the largest and smallest areas. You can see the map on the left-hand side of the slide just identifies the different communities within the boundaries of the school district. On the right-hand side, we have the tables identifying the different ethnic groups based on total population and population 18 and over. The two largest groups are the Hispanic, Latino, and the Asian populations at about 44% each. The next largest group is the white population at 8% there. A little bit more updated information that we'll also be using on the following slide is citizen voting age population data. So this is an estimate of folks who are 18 and over and citizens of the United States. It's based on the American Community Survey, which does a sampling of the population every year. And they aggregate this into a five-year rolling average. So the most recent data is from 2013 through 2017. And so what you see on the map on the right-hand side are areas of increased concentration for the Hispanic Latino community. And you can see where that's in like the La Puente area, and as well as the South San Jose Hills areas. So that's where the higher concentration of Latino citizen voting age population is. You can see at just under 38%. It's the second largest of the protected classes within the district. And then the next map looks at the Asian citizen voting age population. So the darker blue areas show a higher concentration of Asian citizen voting age population. You can see that in the northern Walnut area as well as in the Roland Hills areas. And that population is just under 46% of the district's citizen voting age population. So with that kind of background in terms of the demographics, the questions for tonight, or the input we're seeking this afternoon, is how should these lines be drawn as we're looking to create these five roughly equal population voting areas. And so as we get that public input, and as well as from the board, you know, what kind of things are helpful to hear, what kind of types of input are helpful. You know, I think this neighborhood and that neighborhood should be together in one trustee area, or conversely, I don't think those two neighborhoods should be in the same trustee area. What kind of dividing lines might make sense? Not interstate, but Highway 60. Would Colima, Nogales, are those good dividing lines or are they not good dividing lines? Sometimes a major street may look like a good dividing line to an outsider, but in reality, both sides of that major road are really one community. And so if there's any information that folks want to share about that, that's helpful as well. Looking at, you know, all of a particular community should be in one area, all of a particular attendance boundary should be in one area or broken up across multiple areas. And as we talked about, one of the criteria is to try to have as many schools, have as many voices on the board as possible through this process. So that's one of the board's criteria that we'll talk about as well. So with that, certainly open it up for questions or the public hearing for our members of the public to provide their input.
Any questions?
I have a question. You indicated that in around April 2021, that we'll have to go through the census process again of looking at the data and everything. And that was one of the concerns of the board with doing this at this time when there's a census just getting ready to happen in a few months, because we're going to have to incur a lot of cost again to go through that process when we look at the data again and get check to make sure the maps and everything are okay?
So it's really a two-step exercise that you would take starting in about April of 2021. Is first you're going to see, is the population in balance enough to be under that 10% threshold? If the answer is yes, then you're done. You don't have to do anything else. It's only if the population is outside that 10% variance would you have to make any changes. And so we'll have to see, are there areas that have grown more or declined more than other parts of the district at that point in time? The process of public hearings, there's not the same at this point in time, same requirement for the same number of public hearings. There's no pre-map public hearings that are part of the adjustment process. It's a simpler process when you make adjustments to the lines after the census than it is the first time you establish these lines.
But we would still need to contract with an agency such as yours or legal services in order to take care of that for us, right?
Unfortunately or fortunately, yes.
Thank you.
But you would be dealing with statistics that are based of 10 years ago, approximately 10 years ago, when you do the maps.
right now we are using for the total population information that is almost 10 years old currently.
I have a question. If we wish to include a couple more of the informational meetings in other areas, could those be added to the schedule, or is that schedule the way it is and can't be changed? They're not hearings, but I'm saying we've done the informational meetings twice in La Puente that I've been to, and we may have a couple other communities that we want to make sure are included.
We have a number of meetings that have already taken place across our district and a number that are still scheduled. So what was presented on the slide were the meetings that are the public hearings for the board, but like I held a meeting this morning. So there are meetings that are happening across our community.
Thanks.
And I just want to make one thing clear that Dr. Mitchell met with representatives of all the PTAs throughout the district, including the north side. And one of the comments that one of the individuals made was, does this mean that I can run for school board now? And I just want to make it clear that this doesn't change it. Right now, anybody can run for school board that lives within the district that's eligible to run. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they thought this is going to enable them to run when they're able to run right now.
Correct.
Carrie?
Yeah. For page 6 and 7 for district demographic map, are you able to provide the map with the numbers of the voter for each area? And right now, these maps are percentage, mm-hmm. and that's not actual number. So there may be a large percentage, but a very, very low number of voters. Not today, I mean in the future. Are you able to provide us the...
Sure.
You
know? We can provide a map that could be posted on the website because it would be a large size map in order to see all those numbers. But we certainly have done that in the past where we can show the concentration number or concentration percentages with the total population within each of those blocks. Because each of those funny shaped things that's colored in is a census block. So we can certainly do that.
Could you explain that even though we're talking about voters, that it does not strictly mean voters, it means population.
Right, so our 108,000 population that we're using as our numerator in this equation is everybody who lives in the district as of April 1st, 2010, when the census was conducted, regardless of age or citizenship status or ability to vote. So that's our numerator. But we do use this additional layer of data, which is an estimate of citizen voting age population, which is a little bit more recent, but it's not the numerator in our equation of equal areas.
One of the questions that continues to come up from constituents is the fact of, by going to districts, what if someone from one district no one comes out to run from a particular district, what happens? And can you please explain that portion again?
Or I will let Mr. Wankart here, who is the expert on that, do that part.
If nobody files papers to run in a particular trustee area, then a vacancy is declared, and then the board would appoint somebody from that area, and they would take office when the term begins, typically in December of that year.
And if only one person from each district comes out to run, then it's just the standard same as it currently is at large, where there doesn't have to be an election.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
But then it might be good for you to explain, too, that this election will be just for two. We'll decide the districts,
right.
But in the 2020 election, we're just electing two board members. Is
right.
that correct?
That's correct. And then there'll be three up for election in 2022.
Thanks.
Any more questions?
Can I say something? I just wanted to say, make sure that folks in the audience know that we do have translators available, and so I'm asking them to please come to the podium to make sure that we don't have any language loss. There were signs that were posted, but if you could please come and introduce yourself.
I wonder who that person was. Okay, my name is Sandra Guzman, and I'm the district Spanish translator here, available to interpret for Spanish if anybody needs a translation in Spanish.
Buenas tardes, soy Sandra Guzmán, soy el intérprete en español del distrito y estoy aquí para servir a cualquier persona que necesite traducción en español en esta audiencia.
Buenas tardes, mi nombre es Gloria Basulto, también soy traductora del distrito aquí en Roland. Estamos presentes para proveer traducción para cualquier persona que lo necesite durante la audiencia.
My name is Nikki, I'm Mandarin Chinese interpreter. Does anyone need a Mandarin Chinese interpreter here? 我是中文翻译，有任何人需要中文翻译吗？ Thank you.
How about French? Do you do French?
Hello, 안녕하세요. 혹시 여기서 한국 언어로 통역해 주시면 저한테 말씀해 주세요.
We will start the public hearing. The public hearing is for all interested parties to provide comments on the above-mentioned item. Hearing is opened at 4:21 p.m. Joshua Maddy?
Maddy. Good afternoon. My name is Joshua Maddock. I am a 35-year resident of Roland Heights. I represent the interests of the 18700 block of Honoré Street. The reason why I'm bringing that up is it is a small partition of about seven households, which may very well be mistakenly put in the Killian district, when we're more logically to be put in wherever Jellick Avenue, south of Kalima Avenue, should be. So other than that, keep up the good work, and I'm sure whatever trustee district will be fine.
Thank you.
Hi, folks. I'm Roy Humphries here, and one of the questions that we have here today, why are we here? And first of all, the reason why we're here is on June 6th, 2019, I submitted Superintendent Mitchell a letter requesting that this very subject be put on the agenda for discussion. And I received a comment back from her on June 17th, 2019. Hey, your request is denied because we addressed it on this number SO1781 so forth, in which I took a look and I downloaded a thing. I got some comments on here about that. But something that was troubling is if we go to the bottom of the first page, it says that the board directs the superintendent to immediately initiate a legal action processes for establishing the trustee areas. And it goes on two more times on this here. And guess what? I did submit a request to the Public Records Act to the superintendent, which she has refused to comply with. Thank you. But we have to. What is the meaning of immediate, Mr. Malcolm? I think he has a master's degree. What does immediate mean to you? We have PhD up here, superintendent. What does immediate mean? The people on this side of the microphone, immediate means like get it done. It should be. And here we are, 2 years out. And it still haven't, and that's 16 years after 2001, and we can quibble over the exact start date on that. But this goes to show you the attitude of this. And by the way, I have copies of all that stuff that you can take a look at if you care to. And but for, and I'm sorry, he was supposed to be here. He's going to be here. Carlos Perez. Anybody know about Carlos Perez? Well, he's an attorney at law, as also. And but for his filing demand, and there are a bunch of other legal stuff that I don't know. Talk to an attorney about that. Guess what? This word immediate. What's it, immediate? 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. I'm dead. I'm gone. But that's the look we're looking at for the term of immediate. And but that's why we're here today. Is because of him. It wasn't for him. Forget about it. And what are we talking about? Voting rights. 1965. California's is an extension of the 1965 voters' rights and all that civil rights stuff. With people forfeited their lives for that. Yet the board up here, your immediate, she supposedly works for you. So if we want to look for a fault, just look at what we have up here. And then we have Ms. Pryde talking, oh, my goodness, if we do this now, 2 years after immediate.
Talking about the criteria of the map?
Two years after immediate.
Criteria of the map is the
criteria of the map. We're talking about why we're here, that 2 years after, we wouldn't be here for any of this. And talk about the maps. Did you, the attorney Perez also submitted, very well done by a professional, of these maps. Where are they? Where are they posted on the website and so forth? But we're talking about our something like, oh, it's going to cost money. Hey, that's, what is the price of the vote?
Again, the map.
The maps.
Subject.
Yeah.
If you'd like to give your input.
Just use the maps that he has. And you're sitting on $40 to $50 million, according to Shay Lohman. So let's not be talking about cost of anything. What is the cost of democracy? This is shameful. And the way the North has been marginalized is shameful. Thank you.
Anyone else would like to come and speak on the subject? Hearing will be closed at 4:25 p.m. We will move on to the discussion action. May I have a motion and a second on item 4A to adopt resolution SO-192005, establishing criteria for developing trustee area boundaries.
I make a motion.
I'll second that motion.
Any discussion? None? Okay. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. We will take a short break for recess at this time to reset the room furniture.
I printed this before I left work. Did you see this?
Check, check. It works.
Busy.
Check. Check.
Check, check.
David, check, check. I'm okay.
Yeah. Data, so I printed it to bring you a copy. Okay.
We're reconvening at 4:33 p.m. What teamwork. You guys did all those tables so fast. I just thought that was really nice. And thank you, everybody, for coming. So many principals are here, too. Okay. Next, we will have a report on our district-wide instructional focus areas, CAASPP assessment results, data and information on student academic achievement. I will turn it over to Dr. Mitchell at this time.
Thank you very much. So this afternoon we have our study session. We will be looking at our student achievement data as well as the programs and services offered in the district. And so thank you for those that are in attendance. And at this time I'll turn it over to Dr. Zamora, who will get us started.
Thank you. Tonight we have a presentation for you entitled "The Innovative Learning for All: Teaching and Learning in Roland Unified." And as Dr. Mitchell shared, we will also be sharing our district student outcomes. I just want to start by highlighting how instruction has changed with the implementation of the state standards, the new state standards. Well, they're not so new anymore, but the new Common Core state standards. We are now going from students being recipients of information to students being fully engaged and expected to be active learners in their own learning as well as monitoring their own progress, and teachers being more of a facilitator of the learning and also going more into depth and not breadth. So the landscape has changed quite a bit, and these four core areas impact teaching and learning in Roland Unified. Obviously, we have to, and we have been implementing the state standards. And with those come the instructional shifts, the rigor and relevance that students are expected to demonstrate, and specifically around their skill and knowledge in these standards. We here in Roland Unified have our teaching and learning framework that goes deeper into the expectations of our teachers and our students with regards to their teaching and learning, specifically around implementing our new required areas that are successful learning by all and implementing their areas that have the highest accountability around student learning. With regards to accountability, we continue to monitor student progress on the dashboard, on district internal assessments, and also focus a lot on data dives that lead us to implementing different techniques with regards to addressing student needs, as well as celebrating their accomplishments. And as well as professional development is something we take very seriously here because we know that all of our instructional leaders, our principals, our teachers, our coaches, are in need and also should be receiving professional development to stay on top of their skill and knowledge. And we do this across the board in multiple areas. I'd like to turn it over now to Dr. Rodriguez. Ryan. My apologies, Dr. Huff.
That's okay. So we're going to look at one of the measures that the state looks at in terms of our progress towards meeting state standards. Then we'll switch over to looking at practices, then we'll come back to outcomes on math, and then go back to practices. So in looking at the outcomes of around English language arts in the Smarter Balanced Assessment, this is our fifth year to look at this data. And as you are aware, the overall data is reported on four different levels. So there's level one, standard not met, level two, nearly met, level three, standard met, and level four standard exceeded. So a lot of the slides we'll look at, as you know, in the past, are looking at the percentage of students that achieved the standard met or standard exceeded, so that level three and four. So if we look at the roll-in data on the right, 51.04% of students that are meeting or exceeding, that's level three and four, compared to the state and the county, we continue to outperform the state and the county. And if we look at sort of long-term data from the baseline year of 2015, we see that trend of continuing growth. When we break it down by grade level in ELA, this is showing year-over-year data, so it's showing different cohorts of students. So, for example, in grade 3, 47% of our grade 3 students met or exceeded last year in 2019. And then the third graders the year before are there in blue. And you can kind of you can see in the third graders in 2018, 49%. In 2017, 45%. Third graders in 2016, 48%. And then third graders in 2015, 39%. So it shows a different group of students each year how they performed on that grade 3 test. And so kind of the bigger picture of this is just seeing, again, that five-year trend of from the baseline year to where we are. And if we were to I don't have the state data up here as a comparison, but this the outcomes we have here in ELA reflect around the state averages, except for our grade 11, which jumps up to 63%. The state is about 57%, so by the time our students are leaving high school, we're about 6 points higher in grade 11 in ELA. So this slide shows that five-year growth by grade level. So if we look at grade 3 over the last, from 2015 to 2019, there's been an 8-point change, 9-point change in grade 4, 4-point, 6-point, 6-point. Grade 8 has stayed around the same, but hasn't been any change since the baseline year, and then grade 11 has been 4-point. So an overall about a 5-point change in terms of where we were the very first year to where we are in 2019. This slide shows a little bit different, shows the data, the same group of students over time. So if we start here on the left-hand side, 48% of students in grade 4 met or exceeded in 2019. When those fourth graders were third graders, they were 49% of them were levels three or four. So it shows the same group of students over time. So it went down just 1 point. If we go to grade five, we can see in grade five in 2019, 51% met or exceeded. When those fifth graders were fourth graders, 49% were meeting or exceeding. And then when they were third graders, 45%. So you just can follow through each one of those years. When sixth graders last year, 52%. When they were sixth, fifth, fourth, third graders, 48%. So that's an increase of 4 points. Our seventh grade cohort, this is where we start to see pretty significant jumps in ELA. So 49% of our seventh graders last year were meeting or exceeding. When those seventh graders were seventh, sixth, fifth, fourth, third graders, only 39% of them were. So between third grade and seventh grade, an additional 10% of the students met or exceeded. We see the same jump in the eighth grade cohort. So when those eighth graders last year, 49% were fourth graders, only 39%, so we see that same 10-point jump. And then we see the biggest jump in our 11th grade cohort. So 11th graders last year, 63% met or exceeded. And then when those 11th graders were 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th, 7th graders, 43% were. So we see a 20-point jump in students that were meeting or exceeding, which, as I mentioned, is 6 points higher than what the state averages in grade 11. Underneath the overall ELA scores, it breaks down into subscores, so reading, writing, listening, and research. The claim that we've been really focusing on in the district is around reading. That's what our interim assessments are tied to because that has been our lowest performing. But you can see that is the claim that has also continued to grow each year. We were a little flat this past year, but we went from 67% the first year to 70% this year. And then if we break this down by the percentage of students that were below, near, or above in each of those claims for last year, the claim that's performing with the most students above is the research and inquiry. And then the claim, as I mentioned, that we're continuing to focus on is reading. So 29% are below in grades 3 through 8 and 11. So that continues to be an area of focus for us as we continue to monitor. Roland continues to monitor the achievement gap. It's why we receive the LCFF funding, and it's what we pay close attention to. And we'll talk a little bit more about what we're doing to support that closing achievement gap. This slide shows our overall progress over the last 4 years of giving the test, well, five. So starting at 46% in 2015, meeting, exceeding, and then most recently 51%. So that's a gain of five points of meeting, exceeding. If we look at, now we disaggregate that data by students that are low income, which is defined by students that are on free or reduced lunch or have parents that do not have a high school diploma, then the growth is much higher at 7 points. So, I'm sorry, 9 points, so almost double the growth as we saw overall. So a 5-point gain overall, and then a 9-point gain in students that are low income. So our goal, obviously, is to continue that trend and see that gap to narrow. In special ed, there was a 5-point gain, which reflected the gain in district overall, and then our English learner gain of 5 points as well reflects the district overall. Foster youth, as you know, is also a subgroup that we, according to LCFF, monitor and then also write into our LCAP plan. It is a very small cohort of students that fluctuates. Foster youth are very mobile and come in and out of the district throughout the year. And so at the time of testing last year, we had 71 foster youth, and 17% of them met or exceeded. You can see the data, it really jumps up and down, because each year we have a very different cohort of foster youth as they move in and out of the district. Our Family Resource Center does a lot to monitor them from the minute they arrive in the district and provides the wraparound services that they need to make sure they have are connected with the programs that they need, have the IEPs right away to at the fingertips of the school sites to make sure that they're getting the services that they need. The other gap that we monitor is our gap between ethnicity, race. And so we have the major subgroups. These are not all the ethnicities that are enrolling, but the groups that represent the largest proportion. And you can see the gap there. One of the questions we ask is, does poverty affect this gap? And so when we also run this data and control for students that are economically disadvantaged, again, students that are on free and reduced, the gap does narrow a little bit, but it's not, the gap still remains. So it is something that we continue to look at and continue to identify as an area of focus, that achievement gap in our ethnicity groups. So I'm going to pass it now to Dr. Rodriguez and Dr. Rivas, and they're going to talk about, well, actually, should we pause now, right, for questions? Or what?
Okay, I have a question on slide number, let me go back here and mark it. 6 and 7. I'm noticing that from 2016 to 2019, the biggest jump or decrease. What was different in 2016? Because I see it on slide 7, and I also see it on slides 6 and 7. I'm sorry. If you look at 2016, like we were at 52 and we dropped to 51, but it went down in 2017, down in 2018. So, and then if you go to slide 7, you see a similar trend from 2016 to 2018. Was there something significant that happened during that time?
Not in the district. I mean, part of this is the test was new, and so with any time you have a new test, you're going to see some fluctuations in the performance. So I can't point to anything significant within the district that we did that caused that jump. A lot of that can be accounted for as a result of just being a new assessment.
What year were this? Was the assessment new? Was it starting in 15?
2015, yeah.
Because 16 seemed to be a high year.
Yeah.
I can see why it might drop the next year, because if one is high, you know.
Yeah, no, the pilot year was 2013, 2014.
Okay.
So, I mean, it could have been attributed to that second year they were used to the test. It was the second year of them taking the test, and they were, the first year was, it was computer, yeah, baseline, and computer-based testing was new. They were all getting used to how do you take the test online.
Following up on what Ms. Pride was talking about, recently Dr. Mitchell sent us a list of school tutoring plans, what each school does for tutoring. And it was quite interesting going through this, how it varied from school site to school site. And I was just wondering, when you see scores going up or going down, and this is district-wide, but when you look at it at the school-level site, it'd be interesting to see if there's a correlation between what they have for tutoring at the various schools that are doing better versus those schools that aren't doing as well, to try to identify what the cause is for the increase or decrease in the scores. We have the TOSAs. At some of the schools, is it the TOSAs working with the teachers that's making a difference, or is it the tutoring plans that are making a difference? But try to identify, you know, what's the underlying root cause that's causing the scores to fluctuate at the school site level.
The achievement level, you have four levels, not met and nearly met and standard met and exceed, but the presentation you have only, you separate only, you put met and exceed and the other way and that. And why is that? I'm interested to see all four, because that not met and nearly met is quite different, mm-hmm. right? And I will see how the percentage of the students just met the standard, and or the students exceed as a high.
There's a
that's a lot of difference. I will see if you can provide those data. That'll be much informative to us.
We definitely have that data, and we can provide that to you.
Or you can put it on. I can browse it online. You'll be fine too. Yeah. You don't need to print it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
We'll address
it. And I have another question. The percentage of 50, even our district is slightly higher than county and California, but still worried because this number of students exceed or met the standards only half, but the other half, that means the other half almost it doesn't learn as we want to learn, so they didn't get it what we want them to learn. About half of students didn't get it, so that's very serious. It's no good. The entire California or it is no good. Not even our district. So, what are we going to do to the rest of the kids? They don't get it.
I think we share your urgency, and I think Dr. Rodriguez and Dr. Rivas are going to share what we're doing to shore that up, and then also just the reason we put that data in for county California and the county data is to provide context, because just looking at our data alone, it doesn't provide context on what does that mean? Is that high? Is that low? So it's helpful to see, where do we compare on the district. It also reflects that it's a very rigorous test. It's a very difficult test. Mm-hmm. But you're right that we share the urgency, and I think Dr. Rodriguez and Dr. Rivas will share what we're doing to address that.
Yeah, by looking at the data, looking at this number, I think either we give these kids not proper stuff for them to learn because they don't get it. Half of them didn't get it. Or we didn't do job, they do good job because they didn't get it. So half of the kids didn't learn what they're supposed to learn. So I want to see continued improvement, and we set a goal for at least 80% to learn.
Any other questions? Okay. I know, I left away. Okay. So all of these are very, very good questions. And at this point, we're going to address the instructional practices that are happening in our district. I will address the elementary level, our 14 schools, and the work that we're doing around the academics to ensure that we do meet the needs and of our district. So we'll go into the practices. And one of the practices that we have implemented here at Roland is a reader's workshop. And reader's workshop is an approach to teaching reading and comprehension. And the program, it's not really a program, an approach to reader's workshop, it really focuses on the skills and the strategies. The skills and the strategies are focused on teacher-student conferences and going deep into conversations with books. So Reader's Workshop is very personalized. It's personalized learning that fits into our framework that we constantly talk about and practice each and every day. So if you were to walk into one of our classrooms at the elementary level, you would see students self-selecting books. These books are books that are at their independent reading level. So you would see students reading for long periods of time, meeting with teachers in small groups, and really looking at the instructional needs, the personal instructional needs of every student. You would also see the teacher instructing in mini lessons, using the mini lessons, administering running records. That's new to this year. So the running records is very personalized in terms of identifying the different levels of reading for each and every student. The running records is a way of collecting data, which meets part of the questions that we had in terms of what are we doing for students. This is one of the strategies and approaches that we're taking this year in making sure that we know where every student is in terms of reading levels. So with this data, teachers are conferring. They're conferring with students each and every day. They're looking at students individually. They're approaching our students in small groups so that, it's very personalized. Some students have needs in strategies, others in skills, others in reading comprehension, especially at the upper grades. Another approach that we've implemented is writer's workshop. And writer's workshop is also based on the idea that students learn and write best when they have a voice and choice. Students are looking at different types of genres and topics, and they're giving them, our teachers are giving them lots of opportunities to write longer and deeper on these specific genres. An example of a genre would be informational writing. It would be personal narratives. Those are just two examples. To develop skills as a writer, teachers focus on ownership of their own writing. So the teacher becomes an expert in their own writing. They become vulnerable because they share their own writing pieces and model for students on personal experiences. And so this is the support from the community and fellow learners. So they all learn as a community of learners. If you were to walk into one of our classrooms at Roland, as you see students and teachers teaching writer's workshop, you would see teachers teaching the components of writer's workshop, which includes the mini lesson, which is active engagement, checking for students in their writing, writing for long extended periods of time, and conferring with students. So the models between reading and writing bridge on each other. A lot of our schools have started with writer's workshop and now have moved into reader's workshop. So that bridge is really connecting for all students. It's not something that's new for them. The students would be writing independently in various genres and conferring with teachers and publishing their own writing pieces.
And as we transition to the secondary level, we continue to build on students' content, knowledge, and skills with a focus on the transfer and application of those skills in a variety of settings and situations. In order to achieve this, our teachers have really focused on applying lesson design models to support the intentional planning for these skills, including areas in literacy for reading and writing. So one such model, what you see up here, is one that is used by our teachers at Alvarado and at Santana, which is project-based learning. The focus of project-based learning is to engage students in rigorous projects that connect the learning and the content to real-life issues or situations. So what you might see is students engaged in more authentic reading and writing experiences. So aside from reading maybe from a traditional textbook, you might find students reading an article from a medical journal, maybe reading an excerpt from a biography, a letter that was sent to a senator, as they explore a topic and they construct their knowledge around that topic. Then students would be asked to demonstrate their learning by producing a project. So this might be maybe a photo essay. They might be asked to write a proposal for a new policy. They might be asked to publish a short story. And this would be a means for them to apply and demonstrate the learning in both content and skill. Our teachers engage in a very rigorous and thorough process of planning and designing projects that are both relevant and rigorous according to their content area. and folding those literacy strategies across those areas. Another model that is being used at one of our schools, and this is at Giano, is understanding by design. And again, this is a purposeful model that helps our teachers be intentional in their planning and strategic and identifying which goals are essential for both content and for skill. So teachers unpack the standards, identify learning targets and goals in both the content and the skill that includes literacy, standards for reading and writing. And then they backwards map it, going to developing assessments that are going to measure those targets and their progression towards meeting those goals, and then designing learning experiences that are going to support the development of those strategies in the classroom. So, for example, a teacher group might identify that reading for deep meaning by make it valid inferences from any text is an essential transfer goal that they would want to, their students to master. And so what they would do is then design a lesson that would probably engage students in reading from multiple sources, not just from one, really looking and taking deep dives into what they've read, and then be asked to write a position statement that is grounded in the text evidence that they have read. As we transition to the high school level, they continue to work on building that content knowledge and skill and trying to reach higher levels of learning that engage students in critical thinking and problem solving. We do know from research, however, that student engagement declines and hits a low at the high school level. But we also know from research that when a person is highly engaged in their work, it increases their productivity and it results in improved outcomes. Those improved outcomes then serve to motivate and re-engage the individual to reach higher levels of engagement and performance. So when we're talking about lesson design at the high school level, really there is a focus on engagement. And when we're talking about engagement, it's not just engagement of students, but engagement of teachers as well. So when we talk about student engagement, we're talking about active learning experiences. So instead of maybe a student just reading a textbook and answering some questions from a handout, you might see students reading a textbook, annotating the textbook, drawing a concept map of the concepts that they've read and sort of prioritizing and organizing that information, and then engaging in a collaborative discussion with peers, maybe through a think, pair, share, or a jigsaw activity that allows the students to connect and really demonstrate and deepen their understanding of what they've read. Now, when we're talking about teacher engagement, we're talking about collective inquiry into best practice. And collective inquiry, we're talking about teachers collaborating. So examples of that might be grade-alike teachers coming together to conduct a lesson study. Or you might also see content-alike teachers coming together to review data and to make some decisions about instructional practices, maybe reteaching opportunities or identifying different ways to teach that material.
So across all of these instructional practices that are being implemented across all 19 schools, teachers continue to be intentional about supporting all of our significant subgroups, including English learners. And so the way that teachers are teaching provides opportunities for them to get to know their student. And then with English learners, really know how to provide opportunities for them to practice and to develop their different domains of language learning. So speaking, listening, writing. Within the structures that were just described, the workshop model, the project-based learning, there are structures built in for teachers to reteach. And so that also supports English learners as they might struggle with some concepts that they're learning, that they can have that opportunity to reteach. And then finally, for English learners, really providing an opportunity for them to connect on a personal level with the teacher. These students are navigating a new culture, a new language. Oftentimes, if they're newcomers, many of them were born here, but they're as even the culture in the school might be different from what they're used to. And so having that connection with the teacher is also very important and supports their learning, which in the end closes that learning gap that we looked at earlier on the data slide. And then finally, coming back to closing the achievement gap for special education, you heard from Dr. Tinkup about an update on the progress that's being made in Roland. And just to reiterate the data he shared, that Roland has made progress in increasing by 10 points, so 65% up to 75% now of students who receive special ed services are now within the general education setting, on target to meet soon are the state goal of just over 78%. For ELA, our gains in smarter balanced in students that are receiving special ed services increased from 11% to 16%, meeting exceeding, and we attribute that growth in both of those indicators to one, providing access to core curriculum for all of the students that are receiving services, building on the co-teaching model across the sites, and then also ensuring that teachers are providing the accommodations for students within instruction in the classroom and also accommodations as they take that online assessment.
So before we move on, I'd like to share some of the other strategic approaches that we're taking to increase our student outcomes, and I'd like to share those now with you. Some of those strategic approaches include deep data dives with our principals and our staffs, as well as asking them for their action plans. So every school is receiving support information on their student outcomes. We do that with our principals one-on-one. And then we're also providing that to staffs, either through Dr. Huff and his staff or through our principals. They are very well aware of student outcomes at each site. And we're asking them to provide us with their plans, their action plans to improve student outcomes. We are also training our students on how to better manipulate the device so that they are more comfortable in taking the state assessment. We are also continuing to train our staffs on the district interims, which are the district assessments that allow us to gauge student outcomes for the final exam, which is the SBAC. And when we do that, we are using an assessment that is directly aligned to the state assessment, to the state SBAC. We are also training our, we are also updating our master plan for English learners. We are working on piloting a report card that is standards aligned. We are working on a district-wide student success study team process to make sure that every site has the same language and the same process. We are in the process of adopting new textbooks. And we also do a lot of work with our principals on formative assessments, the day-to-day testing, and the day-to-day acquiring of data to impact teaching and learning immediately live so that students can demonstrate whether or not they're gaining the skill and knowledge, and we can move forward to addressing that through our lesson plans. So there are many, many other strategic approaches that we're doing that may not be reflected here. And so I just wanted you to know a little bit more of what we're doing to address and directly impact the state outcomes.
Then specifically, Mr. Malcolm, to your question, much of what Dr. Zamora just shared is as a result of looking at specific practices, because our schools have a lot of autonomy. They look at the clients and the students and the communities that they serve, and they see what's working. But then together in our principals' meetings, our educational services teams work together to say, okay, this is working really well at this school. This is the practice that we've used. Is this something we can replicate at another school? And they share ideas amongst each other as well, as do our instructional coaches and our teachers.
You had mentioned writer's workshop. Is that being done at all the elementary schools, or is it selective if they want to participate or not?
Yes, so like Dr. Mitchell said, it is voice and choice. So principals start it with one focus area, but with the intention that all schools would be doing writer's workshop, reader's workshop, and cognitive guided instruction for math. So we currently have five schools focused on reader's workshop, 4 in writing and 5 in mathematics.
And again, I go back, do we see a correlation between test scores and those schools that are using Writers Workshop?
We are seeing an increase in the success of Writers Workshop because it is voice and choice. We're giving a lot of autonomy to students, and so they're learning at their level, but we're also instructing at their level to move them forward. So instead of saying, this is the bar, all kids need to meet it, and not providing any interventions or support, we are doing all of that. We're making sure that all kids meet that bar at the pace and level where they begin. So we meet them where they are with the goal intention of moving them to proficient and above.
And our schools did look at their individual data when they were looking at what's their focus area and where they're going to start, and worked with their staff. And many of our schools have transitioned now into a second area of focus. And the goal is that all schools will have all, will go through all focus areas. Every school is still teaching reading, writing, and math. It's where we're providing the intense support around professional learning and professional development on our non-student days, as well as our principals leading that with our instructional coaches on Mondays, and our ed services team being in our schools doing the same.
Yes, and just to add to that, I know that you've seen a lot of contracts go through that supports the work with literacy partners. I knew you were going to ask that.
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
I knew it.
The training of staff.
Yes.
And the accumulation of the materials you need to implement.
Exactly.
This.
Exactly.
And then it becomes the hot topic of the year. And then 2 years later, we see a new approach coming in, new training, new materials.
Writers Workshop has been around for a long time. I had Writers Workshop back when I was a teacher. So it's been over two decades.
It's been around for a long time, but having it within our schools.
Right. And we do provide that. We have Teachers College. We have teachers and principals that are trained under Teachers College. We also have literacy partners to support the reading and the writing. And we have ed consulting to support the cognitive guided instruction around math. So that's where you see all of those contracts being signed by all of you. Thank you very much for your support, because that's the work that's going on. I know that we haven't really gotten into the professional development, but just to touch upon it, that personalized learning with the consultants, they come into our sites once a month, at least once a month or every other month in our reading and writing schools to teach in our classrooms. So our classrooms have become live lab classrooms, where no longer are teachers just sitting back and taking notes and learning about readers and writers. They're in the trenches doing it. And along with that are our principals. Our principals are being risk takers and are trying out lessons of their own, so that when they're walking through classrooms, they know what to look for, because they're in the trenches knowing the pedagogy behind Readers and Writers Workshop.
And all of this is aligned to the state standards, which is an expectation.
Yes.
Aside from all of that work, we're also working with 7 schools on a personalized school success plan that is very detailed around their very specific needs. And it's not only around professional development that they might need, but it's also around collaborating with that school and partnering educational services and the staff to make sure that they reach their goals.
Can we ask a different question? Or the 65 to 75% on the LRE, what's the, how many years is that? 65, what's the years that covers?
We're going to defer that to Dr. Tinkup.
So that's the statistic I shared with you at the last board meeting.
Uh-huh.
I flipped the statistic. This was easier to understand, but the years, to answer your question directly, is the same 4-year span as the ELA gains. So
okay.
Over a 4-year span, we've improved 10% on our students in a less restrictive environment.
And to get to 78%, what do we need as far as resources to get up there?
I think we have them. I think we just need to continue to educate and continue to take a look closely at student need and how we meet that need within a general education environment.
So I think that's really important to have the least restrictive environment for all of our students.
Okay. Lynn?
I know in the
great picture of things. We've talked about honing it down to each teacher, each student every day, trying to make a little progress every single day. Is that still taking place? Because I think that's the most important thing.
Yes, that's where an example of readers and writers and cognitive guided instruction math comes to play with the small group instruction. Teachers are getting trained in how to pull small groups and for what purpose. Is it to address a skill? Is it to address a strategy? Or is it to address comprehension in reading, and same with writing?
So yes, it's a district-wide expectation that we're looking at growth with every student every day, so that we look to see every student has made progress at the end of the day, the week, the month, the trimester, semester, and year.
And we do a lot of that through formative assessment.
In regards to the writer's workshop, I just want to say that I noticed that when we go to a lot of the open houses as at the elementary schools, a lot of the kids' classrooms have stories up. Are those part of the writers from the writer's workshop? Because yes. I know the students are always so excited to show everybody their story, and I'll always ask a couple of them, read me your story, and they're all excited. So I think that's really good that they get to express themselves in that way and then showcase it later. In regards to the lesson design, teacher and student engagement, I really appreciate the fact that the high schools are have their own plan, sort of, their own strategy. So often people still think that education is one size fits all, and what works at this school should work at that school, and then this classroom should work in that classroom, and that's not how it is. Mm-hmm. So I like that you provided us with information on what both high schools are doing, so thank you for that.
What's the lowest grade level for a writer's workshop? Lowest grade level, from what grade?
It is from TK through sixth grade.
So you consider, because for them to write, you have to write sentence writing or word, a sentence writing.
Well, it looks different at every grade level. That's a great question. So at TK, it's all about the pictures and labeling and telling a story through pictures. That's where a lot of the oral language development begins, because you have to be able to convey and tell a story before you can put it on paper. So that's where we start with the TK and the kindergarten level.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
The Reader's Workshop, I was just at Northam, and I was able to see a teacher be able to go one-on-one with Dr. Zamora and to do the reading record. And I know it's so time-consuming, but by saying that we have seen it when we go visit the classrooms, and it's so hard to do it in the classroom, like, okay, sit down, I'm busy, you know, because you have a minute, they have to read and ask questions. Anyways, I thought that was great that Steve Stahl had a substitute, right? It was you, right? Okay, good. And so it was really nice to see the teacher get to know that student and have that one-on-one, which is what Ms. Evan Camp was talking about. So we are seeing that. And the writer's workshop, I see all of that going on in the classrooms when I visit, is so wonderful. The kids are so proud of their writing, and the things that I read up on the board, I'm just impressed with. At the bottom on the writer's workshop, it says the components of writing. What does status of the class mean?
So status of the class is like a check-in. Where are we in writing? Are we in the? Are we just developing ideas? Are we in the middle of our writing where we may need more support around expanding on details, or are we completing our writing piece, and are we ready to share out with everyone else and publish that work?
Okay, thank you.
And also celebrations. A lot of our schools are doing school-wide celebrations.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions? No? Okay.
Okay, so we're going to go now back to the outcomes from last spring in math, and you see a similar trend here in mathematics. So 40.96% of students meeting and exceeding in Roland, which is has outperformed the state and the county, similar to ELA, with a long-term trend of continuing growth. When we break it down by grade level, again, this is year-over-year data, and it shows a different cohort of the same grade level each year. you'll notice that grade 3 starts at 50% and then it goes down in grade 4 and grade 5. That is a trend that's also mirrored across the state. That has the test gets much more rigorous as you go up in the grade levels. They start looking at ratios and proportions and fractions and algebraic thinking. But we look at the overall trend from baseline year 2015 to 2019. You can see across the elementary grades, we see gains, 6 to 10 point gains in the elementary. And secondary, 7th grade remaining kind of flat, and then grade 8 and 11 decreasing over the last, since our baseline year. We are encouraged that, we've kind of reversed that trend this last year, so went up from, in grade 8, went up from 36 to 38, and then in grade 11, 31 to 33, so that is in the right direction. But it is continues to be math, secondary math continues to be an area of focus for us. This shows, similar to math, shows the cohort data. So these are the same students that over time. So if we look at grade 4, 43% this last year, and when they were third graders, 48%. And then grade 5, 38% last year when they were fourth graders, 44, and then third graders, 51. You'll notice that dip reflects that statewide trend as it gets harder as they go up. So third, fourth, and fifth grade, the test does get more rigorous. And then sixth grade, you can see the trend going from 51 when they were in sixth, fifth, fourth, third grade down to 43. Seventh grade staying about the same. Eighth grade going up a few points from when they were in fourth grade to their eighth grade year last year. And then 11th grade, similar to ELA, going up from 28 percentage meeting exceeding when they were in seventh grade to 33, 5-point gain there. So this shows, again, the same students over time and what their performance looked like. When we break down the overall math scores into claims, math breaks it into three claims. Concepts and procedures are the content standards. And then claims 2 and 4 are combined into problem solving, modeling, data analysis, and claim 3, communicating and reasoning. The area that we have been focusing on is that concepts and procedures, because that has been our lowest, and we've seen about a 3-point gain over the last, since our baseline year, from 57 to 60%. A lot of our interim assessments are focused on that claim of concepts and procedures. And then if we break down the claims into students that are below, near, or above, 40% of our students are below standard in concepts and procedures, which again continues to be our focus as we continue to progress monitor. This is a follow-up slide from last year. So when we look at the grade 11 Smarter Balanced Assessment, it's different from, let me go back to this slide. You'll notice that the test goes from grade 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then it skips grade 9 and 10, and then it's assessed in grade 11. And so grade 11 assesses 3 years of mathematics, so grades 9, 10, and 11, all in one assessment. And so this is a follow-up slide from last year that shows the enrollment. So what were students enrolled in grade 11 last year in across the district? So the red line represents students that below the red line are students that were in either grade geometry, algebra 1, applied algebra, or no mathematics. 28% of students were enrolled in algebra 2 in grade 11, so that means that they received all the content instruction that was assessed on the Smarter Balanced. The Smarter Balanced assesses Algebra 1, Geometry, and Algebra 2. So many of our students were not enrolled, obviously, into Algebra 2. And then the courses that are above are college algebra, 7%, pre-calculus, 12%, and then 20% in AP. So when we look at how did those students perform on the grade 11 Smarter Balanced Assessment, going across from the left, this is the percentage of students that were meeting or exceeding. If the students in grade 11 are in Applied Algebra, Algebra 1, or Geometry, then in grade 11, then that means that they have struggled to meet to pass that course. So they have either taken Algebra 1 a couple of times, taken Geometry a couple of times, and they're still in it in grade 11. Algebra 2 is that third course in the sequence. And so we saw an increase of 3 points in Algebra 2 from 13 to 16 points. And then you can see the gains that were made in all the higher level courses as well, in the percentage of students that were meeting exceeding. When we break down the achievement gap for mathematics, and we look at the gain that was made over the last, since the baseline year. So in 2015, 37% were meeting or exceeding enrollment overall. This most recent year, 41% were meeting and exceeding. So that's a 4-point gain in students that were crossing that line over into level 3. If we look then at the other subgroups that we looked at before, excuse me, our students that were low income on free and reduced lunch increased 8 points, so twice the rate of improving as our overall population. So it went from 27 points meeting exceeding to 35 points. Our English learners improved by 7 points, from 10 to 7, and then our special education grew from 9 to 6, so also 7 points. And so again, just the bigger story is that what we see in math, especially where we made the most gain this year, we're seeing that gap starting to narrow over time, and we want to see that gap continue to narrow. Our goal, obviously, is that everyone is meeting exceeding, as Carrie mentioned earlier. But we are pleased to see that we've made some growth and closing that achievement gap. So again, foster youth, you can see the data jumps up and down. It's a very small cohort of students that move in and out of the district and change schools a lot. The average is around 3 times a year for foster youth. With each time they move, they lose about 3 months of education performance. And again, just to recognize the work that the Family Resource Center does to support the sites in identifying these students and providing the wraparound services that they need. We see the same achievement gap when we look at our ethnicities. So the gap does close slightly when we control for students that are on free and reduced lunch. But the gap still is a significant gap. And so it continues, as we mentioned with the ELA, to be an area that we recognize and are focusing on. So I'm going to pause now for questions about the math data.
Lynn?
This is going to be a hard question for you. Why do you think our students aren't doing better in math? I know they're doing a little better each year, but what have you isolated to show us that we could help them the most? Would it be tutoring? Would it be having them all take more math at a younger level? And, you know, I'm baffled.
Okay, so in terms of looking, and that's all right. No, it is. It's a reasonable question. So in terms of looking at math, obviously math is a challenging subject area. We've had a number of conversations, and our principals are behind you nodding their heads saying yes. Some of it is around teacher comfort level and teacher understanding regarding mathematical concepts and so forth and being able to teach it. There also is the there's been a significant change in math having a great deal of language in it now. So math has changed significantly in terms of the way that it's presented to students. Even when you look, when we recently did a math textbook adoption, looking at how much language is in there. So when we're addressing, we are seeing increases in math scores when we're addressing reading and literacy as a whole. So students are able to understand. And then it's also the ability to break things apart and do problem solving and really look at critical thinking skills and be able to problem solve. So it's not just one. If anyone here had that answer, we would have already done it. But we are looking at it. It is a constant conversation. And in a minute, when we finish these questions around data, that we will be talking about what are the steps we're doing in math, because we realize as a district, math is an absolute primary focus for us.
Can I ask one more question, then you'll be away from me. On slide 28, I think Brian said something about the problem was that the rigor of the test was harder, and the class content, you know, was trying to keep up with it. But if we're teaching kids and we know the rigor in the testing is harder, are our classes keeping up with that same degree of rigor and the kids just aren't getting it?
Yeah, so the this test is different from the old test in that it's vertically aligned. So it's on one scale, so it's the same scale, but every grade level has a different cut point. And so if grade three, the level three cut point is here for meeting the standard, and as Dr. Mitchell mentioned, grade four meeting standard is you have to be up. You have to reach up to this scale score to be able to be just at a level three. So level three moves up every year. So as Dr. Mitchell mentioned, the student is constantly having to maintain what they've learned at grade level and reach the new grade level standards up to the new scale score. And so it starts to compound on each other. Which is why that I mentioned the context of the state data, because this is a trend that we see across the whole state in terms of level grade three is around 50% half the kids, and then each year going up through elementary school, the levels start to decrease because they're having increasingly more rigorous concepts around ratios and proportions and fractions and algebraic thinking as it gets closer to middle school. Also add, as Dr. Mitchell mentioned, what students are asked to do now in mathematics is very different from what they used to have to do. So there is a component of the assessment called the performance task, which asks them to do an authentic assessment of using primary source materials and read extensive articles, and then identify their argument for what their way to solve a problem and make claims about that and explain and communicate that through language. And so and that's on the math assessment. So the way that math is assessed, even as Dr. Mitchell mentioned, is very language intensive and is very different than the way that we learned math and how to demonstrate math just by doing algorithms on a worksheet before.
Previous state assessment in math was mostly recall and computation. That's not the case anymore. And so that's why you see the English and language arts and the math scores now being flipped, where it used to be that math was the highest at the state level and county level and in schools and in districts. Math used to carry you and it could bring you out of program improvement because it didn't matter what language the students spoke, computation was computation. So English learners did very well in math. And now the demands of this assessment for our students are extremely different, very rigorous, and also the test is adaptive. So it's a totally different ballgame. Not an excuse, but definitely a reality.
In regards to the SBAC now, if I recall correctly, when the students are taking the exam, the questions change based upon how they answer it. Is that still the case?
That's right. So every item, when they write the item, they assign it a difficulty level.
Right.
So easy, medium, and difficult. If a student answers the question correctly, then they get a more difficult item around the same target area until they've maxed out or until they've hit that ceiling where they're not getting it correct anymore. And that informs their final scale score.
Right. And just as Dr. Zamora just stated, and not a justification, you know, not saying that we're not as bad as we appear to be, but just last week I was compiling some data on math tests, math scores for Algebra 1 and 2, Integrated Math 1 and 2 from 38 high schools. And this was students who took credit recovery or grade improvement. So 92% of these students in this class, in these classes, had taken it already before. And yet the course success rate was only 61%. Overall, from 38 high schools, that was the total course success rate, meaning the students who passed the class with a C or better. And so I went back and I looked at pre-Common Core math scores, and I looked at the overall course success rate for the same Algebra 1 and 2, 84%. So there's still a lot of work to be done for us on how we're teaching it, and the language part seems to be the biggest issue. When I talk to students, that's what they say. So.
But the Asians are the ones who's doing the best.
Yeah, how do some kids do well then?
As far as language.
Terry?
Well, so Mr. Pry mentioned the SBAC test is the second question. The next question is based on the answer of the previous answer. What I'm thinking is, does the kids are familiar with this type of test? Because the regularly we don't test it that way, right? In normal days, only test SBAC test. Use that anyway, and it's different from the kids used to test on the daily test.
So we
don't have chance to practice.
We actually use for our district benchmark tests. We use the SBAC interim tests, which are developed and delivered in the exact same way as the summative. So, students have opportunity throughout the year to experience the test, and the teachers get good data on that reflects how they're going to do on the summative. So they do have throughout the school year, and schools have already started to implement those, and students have already started to take those this year. They're developed by the same people. It's the same item types. It's the same procedure, platform. So they do have opportunity to practice with that throughout the year.
Yeah, my question is the SBAC may not reflect the true level of the knowledge of the kids because of the test, the way.
Yeah. There's so many variables that are not always under our control. Again, not an excuse, just a reality. Is we understand that we do need to increase our student outcomes, so that's very clear to us. But we are very aware of all of our outside influences on how our students demonstrate their knowledge.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, leaving that note, I remember giving the test, and even my highest kids would get so confused because they would ask two different or three different things for one question. And I saw them get so frustrated when they were the highest kids in the class and they knew the math. But it's like they try to trick you when you take this test, and that's what I don't like about it. But okay, so my question was on page 33. So the ones that we don't have any that passed geometry or algebra 1, that's because they didn't take the algebra 2 and the other ones, and they didn't have the information.
I was just part of it is these are 11th graders, and so if they are enrolled in algebra 1, then they have
missed
really
a lot of what's on the test
to pass that course, and they've taken that class multiple times.
Okay, and then on page 32, I know that it has the breakdown and everything. So since they're in 11th grade and they're being tested on the last 3 years, do we give them some kind of tutoring that they should have learned on the other classes to remind them before they take the test? Rather than having 3 years, here you are. If you forgot the last two, you're going to do bad on the test. Do we do something?
So we don't do, but our data shows that we don't need to do that in looking at it. Because if you have achieved and completed through that level, then you're continuing with math, and you're looking here, our students are achieving. The area of growth for us is our students who struggle in math. So our students who have not yet successfully completed algebra or geometry or algebra 2 are the students who then are underperforming. And they're underperforming in class and on the test.
So then let me switch the question. For those kids that are too low because they haven't taken the other classes, are we giving them some information? For instance, like RSP kid will learn at their grade level, but it'll be too difficult because they might be reading at second, but they're a sixth grader, so we're going to teach you some skills in sixth grade. So the student for Algebra 1, will they be introduced anything about geometry and Algebra 2 to get them ready a little bit for the test, a new material? I know it will be difficult because they're already lower than the other kids, but are we doing anything to get them to be able to know a little bit?
So we know that our teachers do prepare the kids for the upcoming test. It's very difficult to make up years of knowledge in just a few sessions or in a few weeks. So obviously it's something that we need to continue to do or probably strategize around how to do that in a more efficient and effective way.
And then we also have summer programs where we're trying to make up some of those areas of deficiency or challenge that our students have, and then looking again at growth. So if we're looking at individual students and what's their growth at the end of the day, the week, the month, et cetera. So our teachers are trying those practices. But again, these are our students who may also be enrolled in more than one math class because they are trying to remediate.
Okay, so once again, we're going to talk about the instructional practices that go, and support around the data that you just saw. So like Readers and Writers Workshop, cognitive guided instruction is an approach. It's student-centered for our K-6 students at our elementary schools. Oh, sorry. Thank you. So we really build on what students already know, and that's the number sense, the problem solving, and again, giving students voice and choice. So the cognitive guided instruction is a way of teachers listening to students, asking smart questions, and engaging with the thinking, all with the goal of uncovering and expanding every student's mathematical understanding. So as we noticed on the test, and not that we're teaching to the test, but a lot of the work is around reading and writing. And so for that reason, we felt that our district had to focus on all three, reading, writing, and mathematics. A lot of the work is world problems. And so we give our students during our cognitive guided instruction math time real world situations. So kids get to work in teams. They get to work individually. They get to ask questions. So the teacher works as a facilitator during this time. The teacher very strategically thinks about what type of questions they want to pose. They do this collaboratively in grade level teams, but sometimes it goes in a different direction. So the teacher needs to be prepared, well prepared, on how to facilitate those conversations around math. to make sure that kids are making connections to the real world. So like we said before, it's no longer about just computation. It's about expanding their thinking and applying it to the real world. So how are we scaling up on math? So we have a lot of professional development going on around math. We're engaging our teachers in professional learning to really understand the pedagogy around cognitive guided instruction, especially around fractions and decimals. We're noticing on the SBAC that's been a gap for us. That's a need. So therefore, we are going to be providing professional development, especially for our teachers in this area. We're also providing professional learning around cognitive to build that conceptual understanding. So even though they may not be a focus area math school, all teachers are invited to participate in different forms of professional development to get them started on this approach of cognitive or CGI. Another thing that we're exploring, which is already happening at some of our schools, is providing parent workshops. Our teachers are getting educated. Our principals are knowledgeable. But what about our parents? And especially because the approach to math is very different from the way you and I were taught. Like Dr. Zamora said, it's no longer about just computation. So we're engaging our parents in parent workshops where they get to walk through classrooms, experience the learning, so that when they go back home, they know what to do and how to support their students at home.
Now at the secondary level, our goal is to continue to build on that conceptual understanding that the students are getting at the elementary level and really build on that procedural fluency. But we have to recognize that there's been a significant shift in the standards that's focused on rigor, relevance, and application. And I think more explicitly, what has been captured as a shift has been the standards for mathematical practice. And I think, Lynn, this might answer some of that. You know, what is one of those big things that get in the way for students mastering mathematics? And it really is dispositions and mindset, too, especially for students who have struggled in mathematics from early on. And so they don't have the confidence in themselves to do that. So with the new standards, it's been an explicit call for educators to really focus on building that sense of confidence with mathematics and how to engage in the mathematics when it gets difficult. Because as students progress in mathematics, it gets more difficult. And a lot of times you can't be successful in the next level until you've mastered the previous level. So the new standards for mathematical practice really call for students to engage in that productive struggle and to really shift their mindset about success and how to engage in the learning. And so when we're talking about lesson design, whether it's through project-based learning or understanding by design, or even our teachers focused on engagement of students in the classroom, is how are we designing learning experiences that really tackle these dispositions in mathematics? So for example, we're asking our teachers to support our kids in learning math by making sense of problems and persevere in solving them. Our teachers at the secondary level are pretty confident in their standards knowledge and their content knowledge for mathematics, and they're very good at those things. The thing is, how do you train students to think like a mathematician, to respond, to stick to it, and persevere in the problem when it gets difficult? And so we're also asking teachers to work with students in constructing viable arguments based on the mathematics and apply that learning. We're asking students to look for and make sense of structure so that these dispositions will help them reach those levels. So sometimes it gets really difficult for students in mathematics, and a lot of times they give up. And so the standards for mathematical practice really call for us to push them through that struggle when it gets difficult. And a lot of times our staff, and I was a math teacher myself, I was so good at math, I didn't think to sometimes go back and say, well, here's how I went through that struggle, and here's how I persevered and it really connected that. So really, the focus of the standards has called on both teachers and students to think differently about the way they engage in mathematics, teaching and learning of that through the math practice standards. How often have we heard adults themselves say, I'm just not good at math, and that's very dismissive. And so that's a cultural shift in mindset that by the time we get them at the secondary level, students have sort of had a defeated attitude. I'm not good at math. And so it's about breaking through those mindsets through the standards for mathematical practice without forgetting the content standards and building on the standards that they've already mastered and that instruction that they've brought from the elementary levels. When we're talking about moving forward in the 7 to 12 schools, one of the goals would be to definitely strengthen mathematics leadership, the instructional leadership team for mathematics, to include representatives from all secondary sites to help us identify those needs and move forward. We're also looking at expanding professional development to support the implementation of the standards for mathematical practice. How do we support students in engaging and not giving up in the math, thinking through math differently than they've done in the past when it doesn't come easy to them? And also deepening our teachers' instructional knowledge and practice to build that conceptual understanding. Something that comes very natural to some of us may not come so natural to others. And so how do we continue to deepen our knowledge and practice around those dispositions to support our kids? So really focusing on both the practice and the content standards to support both the procedural fluency and the content standards.
So as Dr. Rivas mentioned, math is not just about the content, but it's also about the practices. So it's about problem solving and persevering through the problem solving, communicating your reasoning. And so for English learners in particular, that is a challenge because it involves a lot of language, as we discussed earlier. And so the way that teachers are providing and supporting English learners to close the achievement gap in mathematics is focusing on that mathematical reasoning and giving them chances to develop the language to solve the problems and communicate how they're solving the problems and to justify their thinking. And focusing on the reasoning and not just accuracy. So when they're working with English learners in the mathematical classroom, it's not about accuracy in language, but it's about, is it the right thinking? Are they able to communicate their thinking? And then also providing intervention and extended learning opportunities for English learners when they are struggling to meet grade level standards. So similar to the previous slide in ELA for special education, again, improving from 65% to 75% of our students receiving services in the general education math class, and then math gains improving from 9% to 16%. And again, the initiatives that we attribute to that gain in special education is also making sure that all of those students have access to core curriculum, building on that co-teaching model across the sites, and then utilizing the accommodations in the math classroom that's in their IEP throughout instruction day to day, but also making sure they have access to those accommodations on the math online assessment at the end of the year. So we're going to stop now, I think, for questions.
Is co-teaching the same as team teaching?
The newest term is co-teaching. So yes, so essentially it's the two teachers plan together during the same planning period and then deliver the instruction together in the classroom.
Okay, I'm thinking of team teaching where... At an elementary level, teachers are just like everybody else. Some people love math and some people hate math. And it just seems logical, and maybe you already do this, but it seems logical to take those teachers that love math and have them switch some students so they can light the fire about math at a really early level, and it might really grow. Now, some schools might be doing that. I don't know, but... seems logical to me.
So we do that at some of our schools, but there you also enter into some credentialing issues.
Okay. Just a comment, and I've shared a flyer with Dr. Zamora because my department at Mount SAC offers a Common Core for Math, Common Core Math for Parents workshop, and it's definitely something where if we had a large enough group, maybe Ms. Kim would know if there's a large enough group that would be interested in it, where we could even probably bring it off-site from Mount SAC's campus to our district, if that would be a you know, a benefit, that's definitely something that I would be more than happy to look into, because I know I struggled with helping my kids with math. I had to pay it for a tutor because, like you said, I mean, we're obviously a lot older. It's very different from the number lines on the table and the flashcards and the multiplication tables and things like that. So it's something I'm definitely willing to help look into for our district.
I just had a comment that I've gone to the math nights at Telesis, and it's amazing the parents doing all the different math stuff. And then Dr. Zamora and I were at Giano, and we went into this math classroom, eighth graders. I think it was Algebra 1, I'm not sure. But there were two or three students all around the classroom at a white chart paper that was laminated, and they had to do a problem. And the teacher went around and said, I think you should look at that again and try to fix that one or change it. Very positive, not saying, oh, it's wrong or whatever. And he was able to go around and help students, and it was just wonderful, just what you're saying, what they're doing, and what will help them, and their peers are working together. And it was very impressive about that. So I just wanted to share that. Okay. Thank you.
So we all know that our principals are our instructional leaders at the site. And as such, we also work with them to not only raise their skill and knowledge, but also collaborate with them as we support them through their work. And we anchor all of our learning on the RUSD teaching and learning framework, specifically around successful learning by all students and clarity of instructional purpose. Again, we are focusing on formative and summative assessments, and our district interims are aligned to the SBAC. So it is a great indicator of how our students are going to do once the summative assessment comes in the spring. We have professional development for our principals on a monthly basis, where we engage them in activities that they can take back to their site. Again, focusing on data dives, making sure that they have the skill and knowledge that they need to lead their teachers. And many times we bring in our instructional coaches to those meetings as well, so they are also part of the learning and also part of the collaboration with their principal in taking back the new knowledge. Our instructional coaches meet also twice a month, and we provide them with professional development, not only on pedagogy and strategies, but also on how to be a coach to adult learners, to our teachers. And so that's become very positive. And again, Educational Services provides strategic support around our personalized school success plans with seven of our schools, as well as reaching out to schools that ask for help and schools that want us to come down and provide professional development to their staffs or to specific grade levels or a specific group of teachers. We do that if they request it, and we also sometimes reach out to them and say, you know, we can offer this for you. So Educational Services takes pride in providing a lot of support. A lot of it is individualized, and much of it is also based on the professional development that we provided that month. And so it's ongoing collaboration, learning, and providing of support. We are here to serve, guide, and lead our schools. And with our principals, we know that we can continue to grow, which is something that we know we need to do.
Just a statement. You know, throughout the year, we receive several reports from all the different departments, from the schools and everything, on what's going on in our district as far as instruction and professional development and all the other things that are there to support student success. But this is always my favorite study session because I like data and I like to look at the data. But I think that we also have to remember that when we look at this data, as Dr. Huff explained how the SBAC is, it's a tough exam. And I'm willing to bet that there's students who were in the 11th grade who took the SBAC and maybe didn't do so well on the math portion but took the SAT and probably scored very well. That's how they got into all those wonderful colleges that all of our students got into. So while we do definitely have to continue to work hard to improve these scores as well, I hope that we don't see people putting labels on our school and on our students and, you know, thinking that they're not being successful, because working in education, we all know that not all students are test takers. And then the SBAC is a very different test. So I hope we just keep that in mind as we look at this data and as we move forward to make changes. And definitely want to thank all of you for providing us with this information tonight. And Dr. Huff, thank you to you and your team for compiling all this data, because it's always very, very informative. And I think we as a board definitely appreciate it.
Beginning to realize is that you can't look at this data year to year. You got to look at it over a period of years, that you get this, some of it's this normal variation in statistics, you know, when you look at it year to year. But when you look at it over a period of 5 years, you can see progress. And I think that's what's important, is that we're making progress over a period of time and not get caught up looking at the differences from last year and this year. We look at the progress of the student over a period of time, especially when the students are being compared against themselves. And, you know, I think that helps out a lot. So I really feel that, you know, we are making progress. The trend, what I'm looking at, is upward, and that's what's important. So thank you.
Lynn?
Just one more thing. Maddie, your work you're doing with the principals who have asked for extra help, is it PSST? Is
that the Personalized School Success Plans.
PSSP.
Okay. We wanted to make sure it was positive.
No, that's good. I like the work you're doing on that, and it'd be interesting to see, you know, how that grows and how it helps our students, because I think you might be on the right track.
It's very specific to that school. Again, someone said no school is the same. They're not the same students, even if they're only half a mile away. They're not the same teachers. It's not the same principal. They're not the same parents, and so on and so on. So this approach really targets the needs that individual school has, and we only talk about them when we go and support them. And it involves the site staff. It involves a team from the site and the principal. So it's really a collaborative effort. We're very excited about it. We know it's also going to be a multi-year approach. So that we feel that the school is taking ownership, and that sooner or later they can do this on their own.
And the fact that schools have different types of students, it gives them a chance to look at their students and see how they can approach it better. So I like it.
Thank you. Carrie?
I have a general comments on math. I think we should focus on the elementary level or lower level math, because this is a foundation, and if you have a weak foundation, then when you grow up to the to higher grade level, you will never learn. It's very, very hard for the kids. So I think that's my comment. So we put a lot more attention on the elementary level and the lower levels.
For that reason, we're focusing on cognitive guided instruction, because we do want to break that way of thinking. Our frame of mind is thinking I'm not good at math. So if we get them young, mm-hmm. you know, and getting them to love math at that mm-hmm. very young age.
Build confidence.
Exactly. Right. Building that confidence and feeling that math, I'm good at math. I can do this. And so for that reason, we've taken the approach of cognitive guided instruction.
I'm surprised our scores aren't really high, so high. I mean, a lot higher, because when I go into the classrooms and I see all this great teaching and learning going on, and then I always think, gosh, if I was still teaching, I would use that. There's so many wonderful things, and the teachers are working hard and the kids are learning. So thank you for a thorough report and everything that you guys do. We really appreciate it as a board. Okay, may I have a motion and a second to adjourn the board study session of the Roland Unified School District Board of Education?
I move.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Meeting adjourned at 6:05 p.m.